readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we're continuing our look at Summer Sizzlers. As you know, ladies first, last week we looked at the gals burning up the bestseller lists. If you'd like to refer to that list, just check my website, bookreportradio.com. But this week, it's all about the guys. And, drumroll please, I'm thrilled to have Daniel Silva as my guest. Not only is his book, Portrait of a Spy, topping charts everywhere, he also has an impressive catalog of bestsellers. How does he keep doing it? You'll hear in just a moment as we open to page one of our show.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Could he be the next Stieg Larsson? Crime writer Joe Nesbo has a new book out, The Snowman, starring his anti-hero police investigator Harry Hole. And Nesbo's star is definitely rising in the book world. Oslo in November, a boy named Jonas wakes in the night to find his mother gone. Out his window, in the moonlight, he sees a snowman that inexplicably appeared in the yard earlier in that day. Around its neck is his mother's pink scarf. Hole suspects a link between a menacing letter he's received and the disappearance of Jonas's mother, and of perhaps a dozen other women, all of whom went missing on the day of a first snowfall. As his investigation deepens, something else emerges. He is becoming a pawn in an increasingly terrifying game whose rules are devised and constantly revised by the killer. Let's listen as Robin Sachs narrates.
His hand came to an abrupt halt. "He knows nothing," she groaned, sensing his hand falter. "And your husband? Where's he now?" "Where do you think? At work, of course." Now it was she who sounded irritated, both because he had brought her husband into the conversation, and it was difficult for her to say anything at all about him without getting irritated, and because her body needed him quickly. Sarah Kvinnesland opened his fly. "Don't," he began, grabbing her around the wrist. She slapped him hard with her other hand. He looked at her in amazement as a red flush spread across his cheek. She smiled, grabbed his thick black hair, and pulled his face down to hers. She was numb. The magic was gone. The tension had dissolved, and all that was left was despair. She was losing him. Now, as she lay there, she had lost him. All the years she had yearned, all the tears she had cried, the desperate things he had made her do, without giving anything back. Except for one thing. Now she was waiting for the final roar, a bellowing farewell to this freezing box of a bedroom, divested of pictures, curtains, and carpets. Then he would get dressed and travel to a different part of the country, where he said he had been offered a job he couldn't say no to. But he could say no to this. This. And still he would roar with pleasure. She closed her eyes, but the roar didn't come. He had stopped. "What's up?" she asked, opening her eyes. His features were distorted, all right, but not with pleasure. "A face," he whispered. She flinched. "Where?" "Outside the window." The window was at the other end of the bed, right above her head. The window above her head was set too high in the wall for her to see out, and too high for anyone standing outside to peer in. Because of the already dwindling daylight, All she could see was the double exposed reflection of the ceiling lamp. "You saw yourself," she said, almost pleading. "That was what I thought at first," he said, still staring at the window. Sarah pulled herself up onto her knees, got up and looked into the yard. And there was the face. She laughed out loud with relief. The face was white, with eyes and a mouth made with black pebbles, probably from the driveway, and arms made of twigs from the apple trees. "Heavens," she gasped, "it's only a snowman." Then her laugh turned into tears. She sobbed helplessly until she felt his arms around her. "I have to go now," she sobbed. "Stay for a little while longer," he said. She stayed for a little while longer.
Readers, I'm thrilled to have as my guest today one of the great American spy novelists, Daniel Silva. Silva burst onto the literary scene in 1997 with his best-selling debut, The Unlikely Spy, a novel of love and deception set around the Allied invasion of France in World War II. His second and third novels, The Mark of the Assassin and The Marching Season, brought us two of Silva's memorable characters, CIA officer Michael Osborne and international hitman Jean-Paul Delaroche. But it was Silva's fourth novel, The Kill Artist, that would change the course of his career. The novel introduces Gabrielle Alon, an art restorer and sometimes Israeli secret agent. Gabrielle appears in Silva's next 10 novels, each more successful than the last. The English Assassin, The Confessor, A Death in Vienna, Prince of Fire, The Messenger, The Secret Servant, Moscow Rules, The Defector, The Rembrandt Affair, and now Portrait of a Spy, which we'll preview today. Silva knew from an early age he wanted to become a writer, but his first profession would be journalism. He's born in Michigan and raised and educated in California. He pursued a master's degree in international relations when he took a temporary job with UPI to help cover the 1984 Democratic National Convention in San Francisco. Later that year, Silva abandoned his studies and joined UPI full-time, working in San Francisco, then on the foreign desk in D.C., and finally as a Mideast correspondent in Cairo and the Persian Gulf. Silva returned to Washington to work for CNN and became executive producer of its talk show unit, whose shows included Crossfire, Capital Gang, and Reliable Sources. In 1995, he began to work on his true ambition— novels. He started the manuscript The Unlikely Spy. He left CNN in 1997 after that book's successful publication, and the rest is publishing history. Daniel's books have been translated into more than 30 languages and are published around the world. I am so thrilled to be speaking with him today. Welcome, Daniel. It's a real thrill to have you with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, Portrait of a Spy once again features your extremely popular character, Gabrielle Alon. He's an art restorer and an Israeli agent. We know your background is in journalism and international affairs. So is art history and painting also a passion of yours?
It is a passion. I am definitely a layman. I mean, I do not have any formal training in art other than, you know, the odd art history course in college and a little bit of drawing and painting in high school. I don't possess any of Gabriel's talent, but it is a passion, and it is, I'm a bit of a selfish writer. I like to write about things that interest me, and the fact that I am able to weave two of my passions, meaning, you know, art and international affairs and the affairs of the Middle East into one book is a terrific pleasure for me.
Well, okay, I have to ask this. You lived and worked in the Middle East, so did you actually meet the person that Gabriel is based on, or is he a composite?
I would say thankfully no, because I think that Gabriel, while charming and interesting and fascinating, is not terribly... You know, he's unsettling to be around, I think. But I've met lots of characters like Gabriel, and I have lots of friends like Gabriel. And I take a little bit from each person and put them in my fictitious Gabriel, but I've never actually met Gabriel on.
Okay, well, with Gabriel featuring in so many of your books, at this point, does he write himself?
It wouldn't go that far. I mean, I do have to set a story in motion, but once I get the plot moving, get the characters on the page, bring the story to life, I do find that at a certain point he does take over the story, and if I just place it in his hands, he doesn't write it himself, but he will definitely point me in the right direction.
All right, well, let's talk a moment about how you write your books. Are you an extensive outliner, months on research, or do you just get a draft down and work through it?
You know what? I am not an outliner. I obviously have a general idea of what I want to do, how I want the story to start, the kind of ending that I want, but no, I don't outline, and I actually know very few really writers that actually do an outline, at least not good ones. There's a mental outline there, but in terms of actually writing it down, no. So what I do is I do like to get a draft down, I believe that writing is rewriting, and my own contribution to the terminology is that I cannot fix a blank page, and so I like to get something down and then get working on it.
Oh, I like that. Well, how long does it take you to write one of your bestsellers?
Well, I think the more appropriate question is how long do I have? And I have about, 6 months.
Wow.
When I get off the road and get to work. But, I'm not a writer who has a number of manuscripts in the drawer that are finished and that are in the production pipeline. I publish a book, and then I write a book, and then I publish a book, and then I write a book. So I will finish with this promotional tour, take a little break, and then get to work on the next one.
Oh, all right. Well,
that first draft has to be done, by the end of March at the very latest.
Ah.
Ah.
Okay, well, we'll hurry up this interview then.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. Okay, well, your books cover so much geographical ground, and your writing is so vivid in creating a sense of place. Do you visit the places that you write about?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. I try to walk a book from beginning to end. I do not always get access to the places I want to write about. For example, I have never been inside the Pope's private study. I was not able to travel to Saudi Arabia ever in my life, and there's been a couple of very important scenes in the Portrait of a Spy that are set in the Saudi desert, but I've never been able to get into Saudi Arabia. But otherwise, I really do try to visit the places I write about and spend as much time as I can there.
So a reader might actually see you pounding the cliffs in Cornwall?
Absolutely. I'll be the guy with a black book bag over my shoulder and a notepad. I really do try to go see it all, walk the book, walk in Gabriel's footsteps, but, really try to soak up as much as I can, to try to imbue my settings with how they really feel at that time.
Well, one thing that's amazing about your body of work is that your books seem based on today's and tomorrow's headlines.
Right.
How do you do that? Is it just that you have this journalism researcher background?
I do. I think that being a former journalist, there's a very hot book out this month, George R.R. Martin's amazing fantasy book. And, I don't think I could ever write a fantasy book. I don't think that I could create that alternative place. I like working in the real world. I'm fascinated by the real world. My books are the real world, just a couple of degrees off. It's sort of a slight parallel universe, and that's really where I'm most comfortable working as a writer.
All right, so one has to ask, where is Gabriel going to turn up in the next book?
Well, I just got got back from a research trip, a three-week research trip to Italy and Israel, and spent a lot of time inside the Vatican. So there's a small clue, but I can't say any more.
All right. Okay. Okay. When you read for pleasure, what genre and which authors do you pick up? And
I wish I could read for pleasure, but I have to do so much research reading for my novels that I rarely get a chance to read. Believe it or not, I have not read The Da Vinci Code. I have not read any of the Stieg Larsson books. So the moment I retire, I'm going to get a nice beach chair and a big stack of books and an umbrella and sit and read nonstop for a couple of months. But well, right now, all my time is taken up by research reading.
And actually, do you have a team of researchers that work for you?
No. You're talking to the team.
Okay.
I'm a one-man band.
Because I took Art History 101 and 102 in college, and your writing on that is, like, so detailed.
Thank you. I do all my own research.
Huh.
And I have people looking over my shoulder to make sure that I don't make any mistakes in terms of art, because, you know, Gabriel Lahn has become sort of a, even though he's fictitious, he's become something of a fixture in the art world, especially among the restoration community. And we really try to make those details as accurate as possible, because people in the art world read them. And if I make a mistake, I'll hear about it.
So is Gabriel headed to Hollywood?
You know what? It's been widely reported in the press that I've have been talking to Universal Studios. We're working out the last details of the deal now, and you know, our goal is to create a franchise of films, a series of films, rather like the Bourne or the Bond series, and with a little luck, he will be on the screen soon.
All right, and if you had your druthers, who do you see playing him?
You know what? I think my first goal is going to be to get a story and a script that I'm satisfied with. We have to do that before we start talking about actors.
And
there are a number of people that would like to play the role. There are a number of people who I think could play the role. But for the time being, I'm going to stay focused on writing the next Alon book and helping the screenwriters get a story together.
So you won't actually be writing the screenplay. You'll just be editing.
I'm going to leave that in the hands of you know, I believe that movies should be made by people who know how to make movies, and I would like a very, very talented Hollywood screenwriter to take a look at my body of work and produce the first draft of the script, not me.
Daniel, thank you so much for spending some moments with us today. I loved your book, and I know readers will be really mesmerized when they pick it up. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
For Gabriel Alon in Portrait of a Spy, a weekend in London turns deadly when he spots a man exhibiting traits common to suicide bombers. Before Gabriel can prevent the attack, he is knocked to the pavement and can only watch as the scene from his nightmare unfolds. Haunted by his failure to stop the massacre, Gabriel returns to his isolated cottage in Cornwall until a summons brings him to Washington. He is drawn into a confrontation with the new face of global terror. At the center of the threat is an American-born cleric from Yemen, a man who was once a paid CIA asset and is now the mastermind of a new wave of attacks. Gabriel and his team devise a daring plan to destroy the network of death from the inside. One of my favorites, Simon Vance, narrates.
At first, they assumed he was working on a painting of his own. But as the weeks ground slowly past, it became clear he was involved in the craft known as conservation, or more commonly as restoration.
How's that mean?
Malcolm Braithwaite, a retired lobsterman who smelled perpetually of the sea, asked one evening at the Lamb and Flag pub.
It means he's fixing the bloody thing, said Duncan Reynolds. A painting is like a living, breathing thing. When it gets old, it flakes and sags. Just like you, Malcolm. I hear it's a young girl. Pretty, said Duncan, nodding his head. Cheeks like apples. She looks positively edible.
Do we know the artist?
Still working on that.
And work on it they did. They consulted many books, searched many sites on the internet, and sought out people who knew more about art than they did, a category that included most of the population of West Cornwall. Finally, in early April, Dottie Cox from the village store screwed up the nerve to simply ask the beautiful young Italian woman about the painting when she came into town to do her marketing. The woman evaded the question with an ambiguous smile. Then, with her straw bag slung over her shoulder, she sauntered back down to the cove, her riotous dark hair tossed by the springtime wind. Within minutes of her arrival, the wailing of the opera ceased, and the window shades of the cottage fell like eyelids. They remained tightly closed for the next week, at which point the restorer and his beautiful wife disappeared, without warning. For several days, the residents of Gunwarrow feared they might not be planning to return, and a few actually berated themselves for having snooped and pried into the couple's private affairs. Then, while leafing through the Times one morning at the village store, Dottie Cox noticed a story from Washington, D.C. about the unveiling of a long-lost portrait by Rembrandt. A portrait that looked precisely like the one that had been in the cottage at the far end of the cove. And thus the mystery was solved. Coincidentally, that same edition of the Times contained a front-page article about a series of mysterious explosions at four secret Iranian nuclear facilities. No one in Gunwallow imagined there might be any connection. At least not yet. The restorer was a changed man when he came back from America. They could see that. Though he remained guarded in his personal encounters, and he was still not the sort you would want to surprise in the dark, it was obvious a great burden had been lifted from his shoulders. They saw a smile on his angular face every now and again, and the light emitted by his unnaturally green eyes seemed a shade less defensive. Even his long daily walks had a different quality. Where once he had pounded along the footpaths like a man possessed, he now seemed to float atop the mist-covered cliffs like an Arthurian spirit who had come home after a long time in a distant land.
"Looks to me as if he's been released from a sacred vow," observed Vera Hobbs, owner of the village bake shop.
But when asked to venture a guess as to what that vow might have been, or to whom he had sworn it, she refused. Like everyone else in town, she had made a fool of herself trying to divine his occupation.
"Besides," she advised, "it's better to leave him in peace. Otherwise, the next time he and his pretty wife leave the Lizard, it might be for good."
Indeed, as that glorious summer slowly faded, the restorer's future plans became the primary preoccupation of the entire village. With the lease on the cottage running out in September, and with no tangible evidence he was planning to renew it, they embarked on a covert effort to persuade him to stay. What the restorer needed, they decided, was something to keep him tethered to the Cornish coast, a job that utilized his unique set of skills and gave him something to do other than walk the cliffs. Exactly what that job might entail, and who would give it to him, they had no idea, but they entrusted to themselves the delicate task of trying to find it. After much deliberation, it was Dottie Cox who finally hit upon the idea of the first annual Gunwallow Festival of Fine Arts, with the famous art restorer Giovanni Rossi serving as honorary chairman. She made the suggestion to the restorer's wife the following morning when she popped into the village store at her usual time. The woman actually laughed for several minutes. The offer was flattering, she said after regaining her composure, but she didn't think it was the sort of thing Signor Rossi would agree to.
The Kingdom by Clive Cussler and Grant Blackwood is the third adventure in the new Fargo series. In Spartan Gold and Lost Empire, readers were introduced to the world of husband and wife team Sam and Remy Fargo, whose passion and instinct for treasure hunting has led to extraordinary discoveries and perilous journeys. The Fargos are used to hunting for treasure, not people. But then a Texas oil baron contacts them with a personal plea. An investigator friend of the Fargos was on a mission to find the oil baron's missing father, and now the investigator is missing too. Could Sam and Remy take up the hunt? On a journey that takes them to Tibet, Nepal, Bulgaria, India, and China, the Fargos find themselves embroiled with black market fossils, a century-old puzzle chest, an ancient Tibetan kingdom, and a skeleton that could turn the history of human evolution on its head. Scott Brick narrates.
His instincts told him to ride on, that he hadn't put enough distance between himself and... From across the stream, perhaps 50 yards away, came the crack of a branch in the trees. Anyone else would have dismissed it, but Dakal knew the sound of a horse pushing through heavy brush. His own horse had stopped drinking, its head raised, and ears twitching. From the trail, another sound, the scuff of a horse's hoof on the gravel trail. Dakal pulled the bow from the sheath on his back and an arrow from the quiver, then crouched down in the knee-high water grass. Partially blocked by the horse's legs, Dakal peeked under the animal's belly, looking for signs of movement. There was nothing. He turned his head right. Through the trees he could just make out the narrow trail. He watched, waited. Then, another hoof scuff. Dakal knocked an arrow and drew the bow slightly, taking up the tension. A few moments later, a horse appeared on the trail, cantering slowly. The horse stopped. Dakal could see only the rider's legs and his black-gloved hands resting on the saddle's pommel, reins gripped loosely in his fingers. The hand moved, jerked the reins slightly. Beneath him, the horse whinnied and stamped its hoof. An intentional move, Dakal realized immediately. A distraction. The attackers would be coming from the forest side. Dakal drew the bow fully, took aim, and let fly the arrow. The point pierced the man's leg in the crease between his upper thigh and hip. He screamed, clutched his leg, and toppled off his horse. Instinctively, Dakal knew his aim was true. The arrow had punctured the leg artery. The man was out of the fight and would be dead within minutes. Still crouching, Dakal spun on his back heel while retrieving 3 more arrows from his quiver. 2 he planted in the ground before him, the 3rd he knocked. There, 30 feet away, were 3 attackers, swords drawn, creeping through the underbrush toward him. Dakal took aim on the trailing figure and fired. The man went down. In rapid succession, he fired 2 more, catching 1 man squarely in the chest, the next in the throat. A 4th warrior let out a war cry and charged from behind a copse of trees. He almost reached the edge of the stream before Dakal's arrow dropped him. The forest fell silent. 4? Dakal thought. They had never sent fewer than 12 before. As if in answer to his puzzlement, the pounding of horses' hooves sounded on the trail behind him. Dakal spun, saw a line of horses galloping down the trail past their fallen comrade. 3 horses. 4. 7. 10 horses, and still they came. The odds were overwhelming. Dakal mounted his horse, knocked an arrow, and turned in his saddle in time to see the 1st horse galloping through the gap between the trees and into the clearing. Dakal fired. The arrow plunged into the man's right eye. The force drove him backward, over his saddle, where he bumped off the rump of his horse and into the next rider, whose horse reared, backpedaling, creating a choke point. Horses began slamming into one another. The charge stalled. Dakal kicked his heels into his horse's flank. The animal leapt off the bank into the water. Dakal brought its head around, heeled the horse, and charged downriver. He realized this was no chance ambush. His pursuers had been covertly following him for some time and had managed to surround him. Over the splashing of his horse's hooves in the shallow water, he could hear them now. Riders crashing through the forest to his right and hooves on the gravel trail to his left. Ahead, the stream curved to the right. The trees and undergrowth were thicker here, crowding the bank, all but blotting out the sun and leaving him in twilight. He heard a shout and glanced over his shoulder. 4 riders were in pursuit. He looked right, saw dark horse shapes slipping in and out of the trees, paralleling his course. They were flushing him, he realized. But to where? His answer came 2 seconds later as the trees suddenly parted, and he found himself in a meadow. The stream's width quadrupled. The color of the water told him the depth had increased as well. On impulse, he veered his horse left toward the sandy bank. Directly ahead, a line of 5 riders burst from the tree line, 2 of them bent low, pikes held horizontally before them, the other 3 riding upright, bows drawn.
Readers, as your dedicated host, I am always researching new and notable titles in the vast literary landscape to bring to your attention. I check the New York Times, my Sunday paper, I reference Amazon, I consult Audible, I visit bookshops in every country and each state I travel to. I am always out there prowling to find titles worthy of your time. It's my job, my passion, and my pleasure. So, when a reader or an author I'm speaking with recommends a title or a wildly popular author burning up the charts, and I'm completely unfamiliar with them, I feel like I've been living under a rock. Such is the case with George R.R. Martin, dubbed the American Tolkien by Time magazine. He's earned international acclaim for his monumental cycle of epic fantasy. Out now is the fifth book in the series, A Dance with Dragons, A Song of Ice and Fire. But perhaps you, like me, may not be familiar with this series. Let's go back to the beginning, A Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, to meet the characters and get introduced to the series. In a time long forgotten, a preternatural event throws the seasons off balance. In a land where summers can last decades and winters a lifetime, trouble is brewing. As the cold returns, sinister forces are massing beyond the protective wall of the kingdom of Winterfell. To the south, the king's powers are failing, with his most trusted advisor mysteriously dead and enemies emerging from the throne's shadow. At the center of the conflict, the Starks of Winterfell hold the key. A reluctant Lord Eddard is summoned to serve as the king's new hand, an appointment that threatens to sunder both family and kingdom. In this land of extremes, plots and counterplots, soldiers and sorcerers, each side fights to win the deadliest of conflicts, the Game of Thrones. The book is narrated by Roy Dotrice.
"We should start back," Garrett urged, as the woods began to grow darker on them. "The wildlings are dead." "Do the dead frighten you?" Sir Waymar Royce asked, with just the hint of a smile. Garrett did not rise to the bait. He was an old man, past 50, and he had seen the lordlings come and go. "Dead is dead," he said. "We have no business with the dead." "Are they dead?" Royce asked softly. "What proof have we?" "Will saw them," Garrett said, "and if he says they're dead, that's proof enough for me." Will had known they would drag him into the quarrel sooner or later. He wished it had been later rather than sooner. "My mother told me that dead men sing no songs," he put in. "My wet nurse said the same thing, Will," Royce replied. "Never believe anything you hear at a woman's... There are things to be learned even from the dead." His voice echoed too loud in the twilight forest. "We have a long ride before us," Garrett pointed out. 8 days, maybe 9, and night is falling." Sir Waymar Royce glanced at the sky with disinterest. "It does that every day about this time. Are you unmanned by the dark, Garrett?" Will could see the tightness around Garrett's mouth, the barely suppressed anger in his eyes under the thick black hood of his cloak. Garrett had spent 40 years in the Night's Watch, man and boy, and he was not accustomed to being made light of. Yet it was more than that. Under the wounded pride, Will could sense something else in the older man. You could taste it, a nervous tension that came perilous close to fear. Will shared his unease. He had been 4 years on the Wall. The first time he had been sent beyond, all the old stories had come rushing back, and his bowels had turned to water. He had laughed about it afterwards. He was a veteran of 100 rangings by now, and the endless dark wilderness that the Southerns called the Haunted Forest had no more terrors for him. Until tonight. Something was different tonight. There was an edge to this darkness that made his hackles rise. 9 days they had been riding, north and northwest, and then north again, farther and farther from the Wall, hard on the track of a band of wildling raiders. Each day had been worse than the day that had come before. Today was the worst of all. A cold wind was blowing out of the north, and it made the trees rustle like living things. All day, Will had felt as though something was watching him, something cold and implacable that loved him not. Garrett had felt it too. Will wanted nothing so much as to ride hell-bent for the safety of the Wall, but that was not a feeling to share with your commander, especially not a commander like this one. Sir Waymire Royce was the youngest son of an ancient house with too many heirs. He was a handsome youth of 18, grey-eyed and graceful and slender as a knife. Mounted on his huge black destrier, the knight towered above Will and Garrett on their smaller garrons. He wore black leather boots, black woolen pants, black moleskin gloves, and a fine, supple coat of gleaming black ringmail over layers of black wool and boiled leather. Sir Waymire had been a sworn brother of the Night's Watch for less than half a year, but no one could say he was not prepared for his vacation, at least insofar as his wardrobe was concerned. His cloak was his crowning glory, sable, thick, and black, and soft as sin.
"But he killed them all himself, he did," Garrett told the barracks over wine. "Twisted their little heads off, our mighty warrior."
They had all shared a laugh. "It is hard to take orders from a man you laughed at in your cups," Will reflected as he sat shivering atop his garron. Garrett must have felt the same.
"Mormont said, we should track them, and we did," Garrett said. "They're dead. They shan't trouble us no more. There's hard riding before us. I don't like this weather. If it snows, we could be a fortnight getting back, and snow's the best we can hope for. Ever seen an ice storm, my lord?"
The lordlings seemed not to hear him.
Another case in point. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child are an extremely popular team, about whom I shamefacedly had been unaware until my hugely talented and extremely literary sound engineer Steve recommended the duo. So even though this title is not the most recent, it is one of the most popular, The Ice Limit. The largest known meteorite has been discovered, entombed in the earth for millions of years on a frigid, desolate island off the southern tip of Chile. At 4,000 tons, this treasure seems impossible to move. New York billionaire Palmer Lloyd is determined to have this incredible find for his new museum. Stocking a cargo ship with the finest scientists and engineers, he builds a flawless expedition. But from the first approach to the meteorite, people begin to die. A frightening truth is about to unfold. The men and women of the Roald Vag are not taking this ancient, enigmatic object anywhere. It is taking them. Scott Brick narrates.
His gaze lingered again on the sedimentary outcrop, its layers clearly delineated. Then his eyes returned to the ground. He led the mules another 10 yards and pried a second stone loose from the valley floor with his foot, turning it over. Then he kicked loose a third stone and a fourth. It was all cosite. The valley floor was practically paved with it. Near the edge of the snowfield, a boulder, a glacial erratic, lay atop the tundra. Masanke led his mules over to the boulder and tied them to it. Then, keeping his movements as slow and deliberate as possible, he walked back across the flats, picking up rocks, scuffing the ground with his boot, drawing a mental map of the cosite distribution. It was incredible, exceeding even his most optimistic assumptions. He had come to this island with realistic hopes. He knew from personal experience that local legends rarely panned out. He recalled the dusty museum library where he had first come across the legend of Hanuxa. The smell of the crumbling anthropological monograph, the faded pictures of artifacts and long-dead Indians. He almost hadn't bothered. Cape Horn was a hell of a long way from New York City, and his instincts had often been wrong in the past. But here he was, and he had found the prize of a lifetime. Masanke took a deep breath. He was getting ahead of himself. Walking back to the boulder, he reached beneath the belly of the lead pack mule. Working swiftly, he unraveled the diamond hitch, pulled the hemp rope from the pack, and unbuckled the wooden box panniers. Unlatching the lid of one pannier, he pulled out a long dry sack and laid it on the ground. From it, he extracted 6 aluminum cylinders, a small computer keyboard and screen, a leather strap, 2 metal spheres, and a NICAD battery. Sitting cross-legged on the ground, he assembled the equipment into an aluminum rod 15 feet long with spherical projections at either end. He fitted the computer to its center, clipped on the leather strap, and slapped the battery into a slot on one side. He stood up, examining the high-tech object with satisfaction, a shiny anachronism among the grubby pack gear. It was an electromagnetic tomographic sounder, and it was worth over $50,000, a $10,000 down payment and financing for the rest, which was proving to be a struggle to pay off atop all his other debts. Of course, when this project paid off, he could settle with everyone, even his old partner. Masanke flicked the power switch and waited for the machine to warm up. He raised the screen into position, grasped a handle at the center of the rod, and let the weight settle around his neck, balancing the sounder the way a high-wire artist balances his pole. With his free hand, he checked the settings, calibrated and zeroed the instrument, and then began walking steadily across the long flat, staring fixedly at the screen. As he walked, fog drifted in and the sky grew dark. Near the center of the flat, he suddenly stopped. Masanke stared at the screen in surprise. Then he adjusted some settings and took another step. Once again he paused, brow furrowed. With a curse, he switched the machine off, returned to the edge of the flat, re-zeroed the machine, and walked at right angles to his previous path. Again he paused, surprise giving way to disbelief. He marked the spot with two rocks, one atop the other. Then he walked to the far side of the flat, turned, and came back, more quickly now. A soft rain was beading on his face and shoulders, but he ignored it. He pressed a button, and a narrow line of paper began spooling out of the computer. He examined it closely, ink bleeding down the paper in the mist. His breath came faster. At first he thought the data was wrong. But there it was. Three passes, all perfectly consistent. He made yet another pass, more reckless than the last, tearing off another spool of paper, examining it quickly, then balling it into his jacket pocket. After the fourth pass, he began talking to himself in a low, rapid monotone. Veering back toward the mules, he dropped the tomographic sounder on the dry sack and untied the second mule's pack with trembling hands.
Ben Mezrick, yes, the guy who wrote the book the film Social Network was based on, returns with Sex on the Moon, the amazing story behind the most audacious heist in history. Thad Roberts, a fellow in a prestigious NASA program, had an idea. A romantic, crazy idea. He wanted to give his girlfriend the moon. Literally. Thad convinced his girlfriend and another female accomplice, both NASA interns, to break into an impregnable laboratory at NASA, past security checkpoints, an electronically locked door with cipher codes, and a camera-lined hallway, and help him steal some of the most precious objects in the world, the moon rocks. But what does one do with an item so valuable that it's illegal even to own? And was Thad Roberts undeniably gifted, picked for one of the most competitive scientific posts imaginable, a possible astronaut? Really what he seemed? Mezrick pored over thousands of pages of court records, FBI transcripts, and NASA documents, and has interviewed most of the participants in the crime to reconstruct this Ocean's 11-style heist, a madcap story of genius, love, and duplicity that reads like a Hollywood thrill ride. Casey Affleck narrates.
The van was parked in the driveway in front of Thad's family's house, a ranch-style building on the outskirts of Syracuse, Utah. Syracuse was an isolated speck of a place, nearly impossible to find on a map, a pseudo-farm town, which meant that everybody there was a pseudo-farmer, except for the few families that actually lived on farms. Thad's family lived on an acre-and-a-half garden, where they grew their own vegetables, next door to a small cow pasture that provided them with just enough meat to feed Thad and his six brothers and sisters. It was a simple existence, and on paper it might even have seemed pretty and quaint. Thad hadn't seen it that way in a very long time. It had just started to snow outside the van's windows, an angry whirl of gargantuan white flakes. Thad barely noticed, because he was too busy staring at his house's front door. Any moment he was certain his father was going to come through that door with a shotgun, march up to the van, and shoot Thad in the head. Thad hadn't come to the conclusion that his father was about to murder him frivolously. In fact, he was nearly certain it was about to happen. He had watched the seething anger deepen in the redness that splotched across the back of his dad's neck the entire hour ride home from the Salt Lake City airport. His mother, silent in the front seat next to his father, had glanced back only once during the ride, and her eyes had only confirmed the thought. Thad believed he had finally pushed the man over the edge, and now his father was going to do what he believed was necessary. Thad fought back tears as he stared through the thick snow, wondering if it would hurt, wondering if he'd even put up his hands or beg for forgiveness. In his opinion, his dad was a brutal man. But maybe what he was about to do was right. Maybe that was exactly what Thad deserved. The truth was, in the back of his mind, he had expected this moment since the day he had met Sonia his freshman year of high school. A shy, nerdy kid like him had had no business going after the pretty, popular redhead, but for some reason she had fallen for him as well. In a normal part of the world, they would have been high school sweethearts, boyfriend and girlfriend, whatever label meant holding hands in homeroom and stealing kisses beneath the bleachers at football games. In the utterly Mormon enclave where Thad had grown up, things didn't work quite that way. Thad's father had forbidden him to have a girlfriend, so Thad and Sonia had concocted a charade. For 3 years, Thad had pretended to go on dates with all of Sonia's friends, so it would seem he had light and wholesome relationships. He had broken free from his shyness out of necessity, first as a ruse, and then for real. And without that shyness holding him back, he had given in to the impulse to do what felt natural, no matter how wrong his religion had told him it was. The first time had been intense, tentative, explosive, and more than a little terrifying. In the back of Sonia's father's car, exposed skin sticking to the vinyl seats, condensation forming across the fogged-up back window, their bodies arching, while their minds raced to stay ahead of their Mormon guilt. From then on, Thad and Sonia had lived in fear. Thad believed that to his fiercely religious father, what he and Sonia had done, it was an explicit sin. Keeping the secret and the guilt pushed deeply away had been excruciatingly hard, but somehow Thad had made it to the day he had left for what was supposed to be his 2-year mission, the rite of passage for every 19-year-old Mormon boy. First, Thad had been sent to the MTC, the Mission Training Center, located in Provo, Utah, dressed in the standard uniform, white button-down shirt, dark pants, sometimes a suit. Thad had found himself cut off from the rest of the world, relearning how to talk, to dress, to walk, to think, while sleeping 8 teenagers to a room in a dormitory filled with bunk beds. Almost immediately, Thad had begun to feel that he was unworthy, that the secret he was keeping was really a lie to his family, to the church, and to God. But a little after 2 in the morning, his third night at the MTC, he had been lying in his bunk, staring at the ceiling, listening to the breathing of 7 other teenagers away from their families for the first time in their lives.
Comparing Google to an ordinary business is like comparing a rocket to an Edsel. I'm feeling lucky that Confessions of Google Employee Number 59 is written and narrated by Douglas Edwards, Google's first director of marketing and brand management. You see the first pioneering steps of Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the company's young partners, the evolution of the company's famously non-hierarchical structure, where every employee finds a problem to tackle or a feature to create and works independently, the development of brand identity, the races to develop and implement each new figure, and the ideas that never came to pass. Above all, Edwards, a former journalist, captures the Google experience, the roller coaster ride of being part of a company creating itself in a whole new universe.
Larry Page is an intense guy. At least he was in 1999, when I first began working for the company he co-founded with Sergey Brin. Whenever I found myself in a room with Larry, I felt an urgent need to do more, as though every second in which I wasn't communicating vital information was a waste of his bandwidth. One day, in 2002, I ended up alone with Larry in his office after a long and protracted battle over some policy or other. I had fought, and I had lost, and I had come to opine on what I had learned and to extend an olive branch across what had been a turbulent time. Larry, dressed in casual shades of gray, peered intently at his screen, or rather, at his two oversized adjacent monitors, filled with code and open web browser windows. Sergey, with whom he shared the office, was not on hand. Disassembled inline skates, a crumpled hockey jersey, and a Japanese geisha doll kept watch over his empty chair. "Larry," I began, "I know I haven't always agreed with the direction you and Sergey have set for us, but I've been thinking about it. And I just wanted to tell you that, and looking back, I realize that more often than not, you've been right about things. I feel like I'm learning a lot, and I appreciate your patience as I go through that process." I smiled inwardly. It was a well-framed corporate kiss-up. I'd humbled myself and given Larry an opportunity to analyze my strengths as a member of Google's management team, and to reward me with comforting words and reassurances about the value I added. Now, he would recount those occasions when my counsel had been sage and congratulate me on my perspicacity. I envisioned us engaging in the non-physical equivalent of a man hug before I trundled off to savor the moment with a freshly made cappuccino in the micro kitchen. That's how you manage up in a large corporation. Larry looked at me with the same stare he had directed at the code on his screen, as if he were trying to decipher some undigested bit of an equation that refused to resolve itself. "More often than not," he asked me, "when were we ever wrong?" He didn't smile as he asked his question, or arch an eyebrow to signify annoyance. He simply wanted to know when he had been wrong, so he could feed that information into the algorithm that ran his model of the universe. If he had made a mistake, he needed to know the specifics so he could factor that into the next iteration of the problem if it reappeared. "Oh, that's right," I thought, awakening from my reverie. "I don't work at a large corporation anymore. I work at Google." Operating principles. You know Google. At least, you know what Google does. It finds stuff on the internet. That's as much as I knew when I joined the company in 1999. I didn't know what a web indexer, a page ranker, or a spidering robot was. I didn't know how dogmatic engineers could be. I didn't know how many internet executives could squeeze into a hot tub, or how it felt to earn more in one day than I had in 30 years of hard work. I didn't know then, but I do now.
Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything, is Joshua Foer's enlightening and, dare I say, mind-expanding account of competing in the U.S. Memory Championships. Narrated by Mike Chamberlain, who genuinely conveys the author's nerdy and playful persona, Moonwalking began in 2005 when Foer, a 20-something fledgling journalist living in his parents' basement, covered the New York-based championships and met Ed Cook, a memory grandmaster and a delightfully eccentric brainiac. Cook convinced him to become a contender in the contest, becoming his guru and guide over his years of training. In addition, Foer broadened his training by meeting with memory experts from Europe, who, Foer says, makes their American counterparts seem like Jamaican bobsledders in the Olympics. Foer focuses on the construction basics of the memory palace, a technique derived from an ancient Greek poet that takes advantage of the mind's visual and spatial bent. A physical structure is selected from memory, a childhood home, let's say, and filled room by room with numbers, names, concepts, etc. to be memorized, and then associated with vivid, bizarre, or even erotic characteristics. Moonwalking with Einstein draws on cutting-edge research, a surprising cultural history, and venerable tricks of the mentalist trade. It's quirky, intriguing, and you may want to remember to pick this one up.
This tawdry tableau, which I'm not proud to commit to the page, goes a long way toward explaining the unlikely spot I find myself in at the moment. Sitting to my left is Ram Kohli, an unshaven 25-year-old business consultant from Richmond, Virginia, who is also the defending United States memory champion. To my right is the muzzle of a television camera from a national cable network. spread out behind me, where I can't see them and they can't disturb me, are about 100 spectators and a pair of TV commentators offering play-by-play analysis. One is a blow-dried veteran boxing announcer named Kenny Rice, whose gravelly bedtime voice can't conceal the fact that he seems bewildered by this jamboree of nerds. The other is the Pele of U.S. memory sport, a bearded 43-year-old chemical engineer and four-time national champion from Fayetteville, North Carolina, named Scott Hagwood. In the corner of the room sits the object of my affection, a kitschy two-tiered trophy consisting of a silver hand with gold nail polish brandishing a royal flush, and, in a patriotic flourish, three bald eagles perched just below. It's nearly as tall as my two-year-old niece, and lighter than most of her stuffed animals. The audience has been asked not to take any flash photographs and to maintain total silence. Not that Ram and I could possibly hear them. Both of us are wearing earplugs. I've also got on a pair of industrial-strength earmuffs that look like they belong on an aircraft carrier deckhand, because in the heat of a memory competition, there is no such thing as deaf enough. My eyes are closed. On a table in front of me, lying face down between my hands, are two shuffled decks of playing cards. In a moment, the chief arbiter will click a stopwatch, and I will have 5 minutes to memorize the order of both decks. The unlikely story of how I ended up in the finals of the U.S. Memory Championship, stock still and sweating profusely, begins a year earlier on a snowy highway in central Pennsylvania. I'd been driving from my home in Washington, D.C. to the Lehigh Valley to do an interview for Discover magazine with a theoretical physicist at Kutztown University who had invented a vacuum chamber device that was supposed to pop the world's largest popcorn. My route took me through York, Pennsylvania, home of the Weightlifting Hall of Fame and Museum. I thought that sounded like something I didn't want to die without having seen. And I had an hour to kill. As it turned out, the Hall of Fame was little more than a sterile collection of old photographs and memorabilia displayed on the ground floor of the corporate offices of the nation's largest barbell manufacturer. Museologically, it was crap. But it's where I first saw a black-and-white photo of Joe the Mighty Adam Greenstein, a hulking 5'4" Jewish-American strongman who had earned his nickname in the 1920s by performing such inspiring feats as biting quarters in half and lying on a bed of nails while a 14-man Dixieland band played on his chest. He once changed all four tires on a car without any tools. A caption next to the photo billed Greenstein as the strongest man in the world. Staring at that photo, I thought it would be pretty interesting if the world's strongest person ever got to meet the world's smartest person. The Mighty Atom and Einstein, arms wrapped around each other, an epic juxtaposition of muscle and mind. A neat photo to hang above my desk, at least. I wondered if it had ever been taken. When I got home, I did a little Googling. The world's strongest person was pretty easy to find. His name was Mariusz Podzianowski. He lived in Białorowska, Poland, and could deadlift 924 pounds, about 30 of my nieces. The world's smartest person, on the other hand, was not so easily identified. I typed in highest IQ, intelligence champion, smartest in the world. I learned that there was someone in New York City with an IQ of 228, and a chess player in Hungary who once played 52 simultaneous blindfolded games. There was an Indian woman who could calculate the 23rd root of a 200-digit number in her head in 50 seconds, and someone else who could solve a four-dimensional Rubik's Cube, whatever that is. And, of course, there were plenty of more obvious Stephen Hawking types of candidates. Brains are notoriously trickier to quantify than brawn.
Okay, sometimes I walk into a room and I can't remember why. Does that ever happen to you? Oh well, no matter, as long as you remember to keep tuning into the show and to keep checking the website, bookreportradio.com, for great new titles. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you next week on The Book Report.